Studies tend to focus only on the positive effects of standing at work and the negative effects of sitting. A full accounting should also examine the opposite. A longitudinal study of more than 38,000 people published in the journal Occupational Environmental Medicine found that standing or walking for more than 6 hours a day at work was associated with a doubled or tripled risk of needing surgery for varicose veins. Varicose veins are also associated with an increased risk of arterial disease and heart failure. It's possible, though, that standing at work, as with sitting too much at home, could be a marker for other unhealthy demographic factors or habits including lower socioeconomic status. There's a difference between those who must stand or walk for most of the workday and those who can sit at any time. Let me drop for a second. Particularly for those who don't have the option to lower their desk, there is at least some evidence in this study and in others that standing for much of the workday is not that helpful. A number of countries have called for more standing and less sitting at work. Some go as far as to declare sitting is the new smoking. In 2013, an American Medical Association board said prolonged sitting, and particularly in work settings, can cause health problems and encourage workplaces to offer employee alternatives. Sitting all day will help to create healthier workforce. And they suggested that standing workstations should be one of the options. But standing is not exercise. Many health groups recommend that people at work take frequent walking breaks. Replacing sitting with standing does not fulfill that recommendation and may even mislead people into thinking that they're doing enough activity. So perhaps instead of investing in some newfangled elevating desk, you should just consider getting up from your desk every so often and taking a little walk to get your heart beating a little bit more than when you're sitting. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2DX. Okay, as long as I'm on the subject, the U.S. government has released its latest recommendations on how fit active we should all be to stay healthy. The guidelines, as before, called for adults to aim for 150 minutes a week of moderate aerobic exercise or 75 minutes a week of vigorous exercise to get the most optimal benefit of physical activity. But they also made clear that any physical activity, no matter how short or relatively mild, is better than nothing at all. Though public health recommendations for how active we should be have existed in some form or other for decades, it wasn't until 2008 that the U.S. government, via the Department of Health and Human Resources, established its own set of standards, the Physical Activity Guidelines for Americans. The second edition of these guidelines, making for the first update in a decade, were officially released a few weeks ago. Let me drop for a second. The guidelines, based on new research accumulated since 2008, now include recommendations for preschool children between the age of 3 and 5 years. For these kids, it's recommended that they stay physically active throughout the day to enhance growth and development, while caregivers should make sure to encourage lots of bouncing around in their playtime. There are also updates to the recommendations made for every other age group, as well as for adults with chronic health conditions or disabilities. Little has changed in the amount of optimal exercise recommended. Kids between the age of 6 and 17 should get about an hour of physical activity each day and should do activities that build their muscles, like dancing and sit-ups and push-ups and lifting weights at least 3 times a week. Adults over 18 should get some combination of 150 minutes a week of moderate aerobic exercise, like a brisk walk that gets your heart pumping, or a little dancing, and or 75 minutes a week of vigorous exercise, more like a steady jog. And the best benefits would be seen in adults who get double or more of that exercise. Let me drop for a second. What makes the guidelines different this time around, though, is the emphasis on convincing people that any extra exertion is worth the effort, even if they don't meet the above numbers. There is no longer a mandate that people have to be active for at least 10 minutes at a time for it to count towards their weekly exercise. They also state, as recent research has suggested, that people can benefit from any level of exercise they are able to accomplish, no matter how small. Research has shown that exercise can help people sleep better, improve their mood, help for better management of chronic conditions like type 2 diabetes or osteoarthritis. Longer-term exercise might help prevent age-related problems like heart disease and weight gain and cognitive loss. Exercise also seems to reverse at least some of the ill effects of sitting all day. I mentioned standing in one place all day, which, as I said before, is becoming one of the major drivers of chronic disease and shorter, unhealthier lives. So, for the cynics in the crowd, though, the more lenient guidelines seem to also reflect just how few Americans are physically active. According to the Department of Health and Human Services, only around 26% of men, 19% of women, and 20% of teens meet the current guidelines. And annually, around 10% of premature deaths and $117 billion in health care costs might be attributable to people not getting sufficient exercise. So, gang, get those running shoes out, or at least those walking shoes, and burn some calories. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AEC2GS. Okay, hopefully everyone didn't kind of drop their radios and go out and jog. So I'll move on to the next topic after this drop. Okay, last week we discussed how the General Conference on Weights and Measures recently defined the absolute nature of the kilogram, as well as Planck's constant, Boltzmann's constant, the John a single electron, and Avogadro's number. The time unit, has been defined exactly much earlier than this. In 1967, a second was determined to be exactly 9,192,631,770 cycles of a microwave energy emitted by a gas made of cesium-133 excited by microwaves from one defined hyperfine energy level to another defined hyperfine energy level. But here we are only dealing with mere microwave frequencies. What if we could calibrate the frequencies to a laser light instead? Let me drop for a second. This would allow the time between events to be measured down to even more incredible fractions of a second. But you know scientists, they're always looking for better measuring rods to define shorter and shorter time intervals. The Joint Institute for Laboratory Astrophysics physicists have devised an entirely new atomic clock that is now the most precise timekeeper in existence. The clock is called a 3D quantum gas atomic, and it sets the record for a value called quality factor. Yes, that's the same Q that we often talk about in amateur radio, and the resulting measurement precision. Scientists developed this clock by integrating a time-dimensional cube at 1,000 times the density of previous one-dimensional clocks. Due to powerful synchronization in atoms and the laser, the clock ticks purely and remains stable for a longer time. In reality, this 3D quantum gas atomic clock incorporates a globally interacting collection of atoms for collision and precise calculation. Thus, it holds the potential to usher in an era of dramatically improved measurements and technologies across many areas based on controlled quantum systems. Let me drop for a second. Physicist Jun Yi of the National Institute of Standards and Technology said, "We are entering a really exciting time where we can quantum engineer a state of matter for a particular measurement purpose. The most important potential of the 3D quantum gas clock is the ability to scale up the atom numbers, which will lead to a huge gain in stability. Also, we could reach the ideal condition of running the clock with its full coherent time, which refers to how long a series of ticks can remain stable. The ability to scale up both the atom number and the coherence time will make this new generation clock qualitatively different from the previous generation. Inside the clock, all atoms are arranged in a linear array, pancake-shaped traps formed by laser beams called optical lattices. The lasers trap atoms along three axes so that The atoms are held in a cubic arrangement, and the atoms then avoid each other regardless of how many atoms are added to the clock. The gas of the atoms effectively turns itself into an insulator, which blocks interactions between the constituents. Let me drop for a second. Thus, the clock can outperform every single predecessor before it. For example, stability can be thought of how precisely the duration of each tick matches each other tick, which is directly linked to the clock's measurement precision. It can also reach the same level of precision 1D clocks 20 times faster. Here, scientists use ultra-stable lasers to achieve a record level of synchronization between the atoms and the laser. During experiments, scientists found that the clock achieved a precision of 3.5 part error in 10 quintillion. That's a 1 followed by 19 zeros. That's precision, but they'll probably go looking for gamma rays next. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Voice? Unbelievable. But can we back up to the best past subject? I have something to add important to me.
Okay, Rich?
Okay. I have a very good friend. His grandson has autism. Is autistic. Do you know anything about that that I can pass along?
It's a rather vast subject. It kind of jumped in front of us around 20 years ago. There's an entire autism spectrum that contains everything from A to Z. And we still haven't figured out exactly why people get it and what is the cause of it and what is the solution for it. Most treatments tend to be behavioral at this point. There's no actual cure. It tends to be a difficulty with people interacting with social situations to one degree or another. And some of them are very functional and some of them are not very functional. But it's a rather early field of research, unfortunately.
Now, let me add a couple of words here. Dr. Roy, AC2GS, is a practicing physician. And therefore, we knew ahead of time there's going to be an awful lot of people that are tempted to ask him over the air to do a diagnosis or to make medical pronouncements. We've set some rules in the beginning saying, no, that's not the rules of the game, if you know what I mean. So asking a medical question where you expect a analysis and a pronouncement really isn't fair, and we shouldn't be doing that, Rich. Intulio, K2RIW.
I think I'll stop right here. Just wanted to be helpful. Intulio.
Now, this clock that you just talked about, the three-dimensional quantum gas atomic clock, 3 times 10 to the 19, or it sounds like it has an accuracy in the vicinity of 1 part in 10 to the 18, 1 part in 10 to the 19. I do remember reading an article about a pair of clocks. One of the ways you measure the accuracy of a clock is called the Allen paired variance technique. You build a pair of identical clocks and compare them against each other. I do remember reading an article. Let me drop this. Where you can build a pair of these clocks sitting on the table, and they really are identical, and you raise one of the clocks a couple of feet higher, and because of the decrease in gravity and because of the Einsteinian effect, the clock that's higher up with a slightly decreased amount of gravity runs faster, and you can see the drift between the two clocks by raising one versus the other by a couple of feet. That's accuracy. I think we're talking about 1 part in 10 to the 17 or something like that to do that. Over to you, Roy, KQIW.
Yes, Dick, that's superb precision. They've done it to a degree with cesium clocks, although they've had to put them on jet planes and fly them around, or they'd have to climb them up mountainsides. But with this type of technology, you can kind of prove relativity by just hoisting it a few feet. So it's sort of amazing what they're doing. You know, we talked a couple of weeks ago about the difficulty of decoding the cycles of a microwave. Can you imagine how much fun it must be to try and measure the cycles of a laser light?
When it comes to looking at very fast oscillators, the highest power oscilloscope you can build where you directly look at the sine wave is around 500, 600 megahertz. Beyond that, you can move the electrons in the cathode ray tube faster, but the phosphor particles on the screen won't respond that fast. So therefore, you end up with a sampling oscilloscope. Now, I have used a sampling oscilloscope which can display the exact waveform of a 22 gigahertz signal, but the signal must be thoroughly repetitive. In other words, it's looking at the first picosecond of the first cycle, it's looking at the second picosecond of the second cycle, and so on. It's building a whole bunch of dots across the screen. And as long as your waveform is thoroughly repetitive, you can directly display, I think you can go up to almost 100 gigahertz these days with a sampling oscilloscope. But, my guess is you couldn't, what we're talking about here with these two oscillators is kind of a random variable between the two. The waveform, so to speak, may not be thoroughly repetitive cycle to cycle. Therefore, a sampling oscilloscope might not give the right answer. Not sure on this one. Over to you, Roy. KQRIW.
Well, probably if you could sample the laser light, it would be reasonably sinusoidal, I would think. It's just I don't know if there's an electronics that's able to sample at that kind of a rate. But I think it's a sine wave because it's basically a modulated laser light is an electromagnetic wave like all others.
Many lasers have all kinds of simultaneous oscillating modes going on within them. Therefore, the waveform is a lot more complicated than the sine wave in many cases. Over to you.
Yes, there are harmonics. There are continuous wave lasers. There are pulse wave lasers. There are all types. But one would think that they must be able to get out a reasonably pure signal somehow to kind of decode their time accuracy stamp. Because they have to compare it with other things. If it's not sinusoidal and they can't kind of remove the extraneous stuff, it kind of defeats the purpose, I would think.
I've seen some YouTube videos of a very brief pulse of light walking from the mouth to the bottom of a soda bottle, for instance. And again, it's done as a sampling function. In other words, you're not really seeing... It's a motion picture, yes, but it's done by the sampling function where you're taking a very brief sample of a whole lot of repetitive cycles and then putting the movie all together in the correct sequence. So as a movie, you can see this pulse of light walking down this this horizontal bottle. You may have seen that particular YouTube video. Over to you, Roy, KQRIW.
Yes, I've seen things like that. Well, ultimately, the problem is the sensitivity of the sensors. They're just simply not designed to record the result without a lot of noise, and so they take the little cheat of repeating it endlessly, and every time they resample, they lower the noise factor. A much better signal, but who knows, someday they'll come up with sensors that will be able to do it one photon at a time.
Is the National Bureau of Standards now using this new 3D Kafka, Roy, or about to?
My understanding is no, they're not. Second is still planning to be defined as the vibrations of cesium-133 excited by microwaves. That's the NIST's definition for a second. This is an interesting test equipment that people can use to measure infinitesimally smaller fractions because there are some fractions where the fractional error from a cesium clock would kind of be too big. So this is more of an experimental measuring device, but the NIST is probably still, for the time being, sticking with cesium-133.
At 9 gigahertz, cesium-133 clock is very close to what I'm familiar with, 10 gigahertz. Ham radio, 10 gigahertz, we call it the 3-centimeter band. That is to say, at the speed of light, one cycle moves 3 centimeters, roughly 1 inch, a little bit more than 1 inch. So each of the waves coming out of that cesium clock are approximately an inch apart if they were traveling through a vacuum at the speed of light. For the time being, that's pretty good. But I can see how in the near future we're going to want to do better than that. There are certain kinds of timing of chemical reactions in which I think they divide time a lot finer than that. I believe you discussed that a week or two ago, Roy. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things being measured that you wouldn't possibly imagine. They measured how long it takes for the photoelectric effect from the time that the electromagnetic wave impacts the electron to the electron jumping out of the valence shell. And they'll keep doing it. They'll find shorter and shorter intervals, and they'll take the atoms apart more and more as time goes on. It's the nature of science to kind of rip through the limitations of test equipment. So it's, you know, this is a real golden age of science. It's been going on for more than 100 years, and hopefully it'll continue a lot longer. And it's just fascinating.
Go ahead, that person.
Clay Dick, M. Zuio, talking about clocks. I bought a long time ago on eBay, don't know where it is or maybe I even have it anymore. It was in a metal box. It didn't come with a schematic or anything. It was an Ophidian stand. Anybody, do you, Dick, or Roy, or anybody on Facebook, where to get another one, where the diagram?
Yeah, a number of the guys who use the 10 gigahertz ham band, and they want to make sure that they're the two guys on two separate mountains are going to be on the right frequency. You can easily be 100 kc wrong in the way you build your down converter for the 10 gigahertz ham band. And to be to the nearest few cycles, they were using rubidium oscillators, portable rubidium oscillators, the guys on 10 gigs. So, the next time I look at some of those websites, I know that these guys are buying rubidium clocks at less than infinite prices. So the next time I get a chance, I'll see if I can find one of those places where you might be able to replace that, if that's what you want to do, Rich. Go ahead.
By the way, the repeater's just starting to crackle again. Is it possible to buy that and hook it up, stretch away to a motorized, regular clock that's motorized? Probably be a big undertaking.
There are clocks and watches you can buy these days that periodically look at the NBS signal, and therefore they keep the same accuracy as the National Bureau of Standards. That would be a much simpler way of solving this if you want to have a very accurate clock. Rich, go ahead.
No, I have one of those. It's just, I wonder the building. What is closer, rubidium or cesium?
They literally use both. Cesium has higher accuracy, but a lot more standard deviation. It's a noisier signal. So they build a rubidium oscillator and stabilize it with a cesium oscillator, if you know what I mean. So if you really want the best possible combination, cesium disciplining rubidium is the way to do it. Let me turn it back to Roy, AC2GS, K2LIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Yes, Dick, thank you. I would also suggest, if you're just curious, you might try eBay. I'm willing to bet you that somewhere someone's trying to sell a rubidium time standard. You know, there's a lot of interesting 10 megahertz time standards. My particular radio now uses, I think, just an oven crystal, but it is a ground position satellite disciplined oscillator. So it does correct for the slight fluctuations of the crystal. But if you're curious just of what's out there, you could take a look at eBay. I think it's a bit of a kludge to kind of put that on top of a standard brushless motor movement on a clock, though.
All right, guys. I'll look around. And maybe I can actually make it into a... What do you think, Dick O'Roy? Maybe I can make it into a frequency counter. I know there are counters out there that you can buy that will take in an external input.
The ridiculously high microwave frequency that rubidium works at, and you need a countdown circuit to get it down to the 10 megacycle or the 1 second situation. I'm hearing that those scattering static crashes in the background. I guess we got some kind of a rain happening at the repeater site tonight, is my guess. I've seen people write articles about doing that, and there's a lot more to it than first meets the eye, Rich. If you're not in a well-equipped microprocessor-like laboratory to do it homebrew, it's not easy. Do a lot of research as to what people have done before you start buying the hardware, is my suggestion. Back to you, Roy. Keep your eyes on it.
Yes, I would agree with you, Dick. It's nice to kind of blue sky it. That's one of the pleasures of going through eBay. Most of the time I look for things in eBay that I have no intention of buying, and thankfully I stay with it that way. Just to get a sense of what's out there, what it looks like, how much it costs, what are the specs that they're showing. But again, it seems like a heavy-duty research project that you would need a significant technical lab to do with in any legitimate way.
I think we ought to give a little bit of extra time to Paul tonight because he's going to have quite a bit of information, as I see, about the InSight spacecraft. So maybe go through one more if you'd like to, Roy. Go ahead. Q2LAW.
Okay, very good, Dick. Okay, this will be my swan song. Scientists have discovered an Ice Age asteroid crater beneath Greenland's glacier, and it's the first impact crater discovered under one of Earth's ice buried beneath a half mile of snow and ice in Greenland. Scientists have uncovered an impact crater large enough to swallow the District of Columbia. The findings suggest that a giant iron asteroid smashed into what is today a glacier during the last ice age, an era known as the Pleistocene epoch. It started somewhere around 2.6 million years ago and ended only 11,700 years ago. Mega-like saber-toothed cats died out while humanity inherited the Earth. The discovery could lead to insights into ice age climate and the effects on it from the eruption of debris that could have resulted from such a cataclysmic collision. This discovery was published recently in the journal Science Advances. In 2015, researchers were analyzing a NASA map of Greenland when they noticed an enormous circular depression on the Hiawatha Glacier at Greenland's northern tip. For 3 days in May 2016, this team flew over the crater in a German airplane with ice-penetrating radar drawing imaginary grid lines across the surface. Let me drop for a second. Every second, the radar sent 12,000 radio pulses down into the ice, reflecting off the ice layers and allowing the team to measure the thickness, the structure, and the age of the ice sheet. The aerial survey confirmed that there was a huge pit with an elevated circular rim and uplifting structure in the center, all telltale signs of an impact crater. The team's analysis showed that the Hiawatha crater was nearly 1,000 feet deep and 20 miles in diameter, placing it among the Earth's 25 largest impact craters, although much smaller than the 90-mile crater left by the dino-busting Chicxulub impact. The bowl of the crater presses right up against the edge of the glacier, giving the wandering ice sheet a semicircular-like appearance. It is visible from above. Breaking out from that semicircle is a white tongue of ice, a large river containing sediments from the bottom of the ice sheet. Let me drop for a second. Researchers ventured to the floodplains via helicopters and collected sediments. They found that the pieces were highly shocked quartz, which is a signal that violent impact had occurred at some time in the area's history. The area's sediment also had high concentrations of nickel, cobalt, chromium, gold, and platinum. That's an indicator that the meteorite was made out of iron. Now, because the team has not yet searched for the ejected material from the impact in the ice cores, they can't establish an accurate date for the impact, beyond saying that it occurred during the Pleistocene. Their next step will be to determine whether the asteroid smashed into a glacier or an area that was subsequently covered by ice, to assess the climactic effect of that particular impact. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Did you say that that was something like 90 miles in diameter? I think the meteor crater in Arizona is only something like a mile in diameter, so this thing is hugely bigger than that great big hole in the ground that we've seen in Arizona. Over to you, Roy.
No, this particular meteorite caused a 20-mile crater. The 90-mile crater was the enormous one that possibly killed the dinosaurs. That's in the under the water near Mexico.
Near the Yucatan Peninsula. So, meteor crater in Arizona, I think, is around a mile. So this one that you're talking about under Greenland, 20 miles. That means it's got 400 times more area. That was a biggie. Guarantee that disturbed the weather for a while when that one hit. Go ahead.
Yes, I would agree. I mean, this is going to kind of rewrite the Pleistocene history books. I don't think anyone had the faintest idea that, there's always the probability that meteors will hit the Earth. They come in different shapes and different sizes, but we don't have too much in the way of specifics. So this is interesting new news, and it'll sort of be interesting as they plumb the depths of this glacier to figure out whether it pounded itself into the glacier or it pounded itself into the soil before the glacier moved on to it. So it's, again, another fascinating discovery, another thing that's going to rewrite the books.
Roy, Pleistocene is roughly how many years ago?
The Pleistocene epoch started around 2.6 million years ago. They reckon that it ended about 11,700 years ago. That's the way they define the Pleistocene epoch.
That's getting close to the time that Homo sapiens were coming along, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, modern man approximately has been running around this globe for about 70,000 years, give or take a little bit. So it's possible that it struck at that time. It's more likely that it struck early in the Pleistocene, you know, back about 2.5 million years ago, when most of our ancestors were still just kind of scratching themselves in Africa.
They hadn't yet gotten their eviction notice from Africa. Oh, you're right.
Well, it seems that we've curious creatures, and you know, it's not something novel that we came up with the last 1,000 or 2,000 years ago. Way back, one of the first things that the proto-man appears to have had was the curiosity of what's that damn thing over the hill there, and so you'll see a lot of reports of genetic variations that seem to indicate that early proto-man left the usual area that we assume we evolved from went to Asia, went to Europe, went all over the darn place, and a lot of times they came back. There's a lot of mixing and stirring that went on. So we're a curious breed. We have been for thousands and thousands of years. So it's not as much an eviction notice as it is, in Yiddish they have the term spielkes, ants in your pants. They kind of get tired of the same old, and they want to see what's over the hill.
And there is a philosophy, the only way that mankind really makes progress is by displaying curiosity. Cody Roy.
Well, I tend to think of it as one of the better traits of mankind. I have a nice little poster of Albert Einstein, and it says, I have no special talents, I am only passionately curious. I think that curiosity has gotten us in the good places that we have gotten to today. Okay, and on that note, let me just remind people once again, all the stuff that I talk about, if you're interested, if you're curious, if you want to see the YouTubes, if you want to read the articles, you go to roy.ac2gs.com on the browser, and it will be available to you soon after the TechNet is over. Do not try and contact me by writing the web administrator of that web page, because it's not me, it's someone else. If you want to write to me, it's mailbag@acgs.com. So please, scribble that down someplace. As long as you address it to the domain ac2gs.com, pretty much everything that ends with that will come to me. So use that, don't use the web page. And thank you very much, Dick, for the opportunity, and on to the space report.
Thank you, Roy. I got one quick question for you. Last week, you stopped for a while in the middle of your science talk because you had a computer glitch. That makes it sound like you're using something like a teleprompter while you're giving your presentation. Is there a little bit of truth in that? Go ahead.
I kind of play with all kinds of things. I'll read it off a piece of paper. I'll read it off of a window on the computer, and I'll play around with a teleprompter. Unfortunately, the guys who wrote the software for the teleprompter felt the need to improve it, and apparently they've improved it so that it gets stuck a lot. So I have to have a long chat with those guys. But, you know, I like to break it up and try different modalities. I've gotten some criticism from people that suggest that reading from any kind of a script isn't that good because I'm not a great actor. But I never expected to be a great actor.
Don't worry. It sounds good. Keep doing it. Okay, Paul, WS2N. What in the world is going on with InSight? You've got it, Paul. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And InSight, of course, is the main topic for tonight. That will be landing on Mars tomorrow, roughly around 3 o'clock. Compared to 2 before. The thing I would recommend is to look at NASA.com and somehow get to the NASA TV. So they're definitely going to have live coverage of this starting at around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So if you happen to be home, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, they'll give you all the information of what's going to be going on as the InSight comes bowing through the atmosphere at 13,000 miles an hour to a slow landing of 5 miles per hour. Let me drop it. So I know we've covered that InSight many times on this net, but this thing has been in development for some of these guys working on it for over 7 years. It was supposed to take off a little over 2 years ago, but what happened was they had problems with seismometer. Inside is a mission to detect what's going on inside that planet. They don't really care what's above the planet. They don't care about mountains. In fact, they're landing in a desert-like location. Nothing around. And the idea of that is so that they can put a seismometer on the surface and detect Mars quakes. If, you know, an asteroid or something hits or on the other side, or some kind of movement on the planet, they're going to be able to detect it. So around 2 years ago, the company that was involved with making this was being done in France by CNES. CNES is the space agency for France. And they were having problems with the tank itself. Hold an extremely strong volume of vacuum. The canister has to be almost 100% vacuum. They couldn't do that, and they showed slight weakness every now and then, no matter what they did. You know, whatever they tried, after a while they gave up and gave it to Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California to finish it off, see what they could do with it, and they eventually succeeded. But that delay, that time frame when the thing was not ready to be delivered by spacecraft, they lost time, and they had to delay that mission for almost 2 years. You get to Mars, it's roughly a little over a 2 year window. Every 2 years, Mars and Earth winds up just right where you can make it there in 6 or 8 months. And that's what they did, and that's why they're landing there tomorrow. This thing was launched back in April, successfully launched from California. First time California and Vandenberg Air Force Base ever launched an interplanetary anything from that location. It was put on top of an Atlas V rocket and successfully launched. First stage separated, the second stage was still attached, put it into a orbit where it was about to be called the they call it the Mars Transfer Orbit, so MTA. MTO was achieved with this second stage burning. But the second stage, in the back of the second stage, they had two satellites, CubeSats, sitting attached to it. So now this thing was pushing InSight away from Earth. InSight was getting about to be released. Right after they released it, the second stage, the aft part of that second stage, had these two satellites on it, called Marco satellites. CubeSat separated from that and followed InSight all the way to Mars. You know, this happened back in April. Both Marco satellites, they tested them, and they have cameras on board. The transmitter is an X-band, it sends signals back to Earth, and it also receives UHF. The idea of these two Marco A and Marco B are to be used as repeaters, really cross-band repeaters. It's going to pick up the UHF signal from InSight as it goes through the atmosphere and it's about on Mars from about 2,000 miles up. They're slightly drifting behind the InSight, but they're going to be relatively high, a couple of thousand miles above the surface. I think around 3,000 to be exact when they receive the signal, when InSight has landed. So these transponders are a little different than what they have flying around Mars. They have half a dozen satellites going around Mars now, which they'll be using as relay satellites. In fact, if these Marco satellites don't even work out, all is not lost, because these are really test satellites. They're proof of concept satellites. The transmissions will go directly to Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter and also a Mars Odyssey, which are present in orbit around Mars. have store and forward type of systems. In other words, your signal's going to go up, it's going to store it on MRO, and then as the MRO goes around the planet, you have to wait about an hour and a half to 2 hours before you get transmission from that satellite, what they picked up from InSight. But rather than wait, they have the MARCO satellites, which will work as real-time transponders. You know, real repeaters. The signal is going to come up and immediately sent back to Earth, where they don't have that capability on MRO. MRO electronic radio does not have that similar setup. It can't receive and transmit on X-band. It can receive and then eventually transmit on X-band. So that's the difference. So, as InSight comes through the atmosphere, and I've gone through this, I think last week and maybe even the week before on how they go about doing this, the lander is about 850-pound lander, so it gives you an idea. It's less than half the weight of Curiosity, which has been riding around since August of 2012. Curiosity is still very successful rover driving around on Mars, but much heavier. So this particular mission does not need the elaborate setup that Mars Curiosity has. This has a similar setup to the Mars Phoenix mission, which was very successful in 2007 and landed roughly near the North Pole of Mars, not quite that far north, in the Northern Hemisphere. That was very successful, very similar landing system as the Phoenix mission. So what they're going to do is come through the atmosphere, almost 13,000 miles an hour, I think it's 12,500 or something. They'll be picking up speed as they're coming to Mars, but once they hit that atmosphere, which is about 70 or 80 miles up, things will start to change. So, you know, I would say about a few minutes before they hit that atmosphere, they're attached to the cruise stage. Cruise stage brought them all the way from Earth to Mars. Cruise stage has solar panels and the capability of recharging the batteries that are on InSight. This way, you'll have plenty of battery power when InSight gets down to the surface. Just for the first few hours, won't have any way of charging their batteries. It's going to take a couple of hours before InSight is able to open up these 8-foot diameter solar panels. So here they are up 70 miles above the surface, coming through at around 12 degrees. Get there, they have these little gas jets surrounding these spacecraft, you know, on the entry stage, and it will orient itself with the heat shield, you know, pointing forward, going toward the atmosphere, and then the heat shield will heat up to over 1,000 degrees centigrade, eventually down to around 1,000 miles per hour. The aeroshell that the spacecraft is in will release the parachute. It's almost, I think the parachute is around 40 feet in diameter. It's one parachute. It's interesting when predecessor, the Phoenix lander, when that came through, that had a parachute as well. That was able to be photographed by Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. They had a high-rise camera on that. There are pictures of the parachute and the craft entering the atmosphere. Maybe they'll have a chance to do that with this one as well. They're going to try. But nevertheless, after it gets down to a slower speed, they'll start to, they won't need the heat shield anymore. The heat shield will separate. It's got six bolts on it that are pyrotechnically separated. So these explosive bolts would go off. The shield will separate. And then right after that, you have three landing legs that also have pyrotechnics attached to that. They'll explode, and the spring-operated legs, three landing legs will open up on a craft. Right after that, they have radar that comes on, and radar is at the, they have eight radar antennas on the bottom of the spacecraft to cover that, and you're on the net too. Four transmitting ones and four receiving ones. They're able to tell how high they are above the surface, and also how far they are, you know, port side and starboard to, you know, wherever they're going. That sends information back to the computer, and with that they'll know when to separate from the back shell of this aeroshell. They're still inside the back shell, and with the parachute attached, that will separate, and inside will just take a fall, dropping away from the back shell. Free falling for a little bit, you know, a second or two, and then they're going to have these 12 thrusters that are going to come on. These thrusters are made by Aerojet Rocketdyne. They have these little pulsing thrusters, the MR-107N thrusters. They're going to come on. If one or two fail, they have redundancy, it will still make it. But they hope it won't. They'll be coming down on these 12 thrusters, and they'll come in for a landing, hopefully right where they want to land. They've checked with the orbiting spacecraft. They know this particular landing spot should be very good. They don't think there's any big, heavy rocks underneath the ground. They don't need that. Looking at the surface, the surface shows very little rocks. Stands the reason right underneath, they probably don't have any rocks either, or very few rocks. They need that for a reason. They need to be able to, over time, they have a robotic arm, they need to put a heat detecting unit called HT3. They're going to put that onto the surface of Mars. And that thing has a punch type of mechanism, full point type of. It's actually going to hammer its way into the surface. The motor's going to turn inside, and it's going to be turning against the cam. The cam is pushing this piston up against the spring. After the motor comes off the cam, it's going to drive, you know, come straight down and start pounding itself into the surface. And then the motor comes up, you know, it keeps spinning. We'll rotate the cam up again, and the spring will act. This will do this hundreds and hundreds of times. It might take a month or so before it ever gets down to where it's supposed to be, 16 feet below the ground. So every now and then, when it gets down a foot or 2 feet, it's going to take readings. They want to find out heat readings, how much heat is lost or gained, as far as they go down, all the way down to 15 or 16 feet. So that's one experiment. That's going to tell the scientists a lot about something about the interior of Mars, about how much relative heat it gives up, you know, per millisecond or whatever it is. The other main experiment is the seismometer. And that's, again, located on top of the spacecraft. Scientists have wanted to put another seismometer on Mars back in the early Viking days. The two missions that went, it was Viking 1 and 2, they landed on Mars. They had many different types of experiments on those landers. And one of the things that they had was a seismometer, but they had the seismometer attached to the spacecraft, and because of the way things were with the spacecraft itself, it couldn't detect anything. It needed to actually be on the surface. So here we are decades later, and they know how to do it. They're going to take this robotic arm, they're going to take the seismometer off the top of InSight, and they're going to place it onto the surface. And then they also have a cover that's going to go over that, put the cover on. The seismometer is very sensitive. They say it can detect the width of an atom, any kind of a movement. So They don't need any wind. They don't need heat to go in on. They have hot and cold on Mars, of course. Maybe 100 degree swing from day to night. That will cause problems. And this cover going on top will stop the air. Will slow down the transfer. It won't affect the seismometers. So that's the story on InSight. Those are your two main detectors that they're doing. One that's going to pound itself into the surface. They wanted to do that since, I guess, 2001 or so, when they lost another lander that they tried to land on Mars. That was called Mars Polar Lander. Mars Polar Lander was supposed to land near the south shore, the south pole of Mars. And it didn't work. They coming down and the rockets failed and the thing crashed into the surface when we dropped. But before that happened, they had these this other gadget that was attached to the Mars Polar Lander that separated from it, and without a parachute or anything, the probes were going to push themselves into the ground. As they hit the ground, they thought they were going to go in around 2 feet. There was a antenna that would wind up staying above the surface, and it was supposed to transmit information up to one of the satellites, Mars Global Surveyor. That Mars Global Surveyor is not functioning anymore, but at that time it was. And it failed. And for some reason, that failed as well. The scientists are finally getting a chance to two of the main experiments that they wanted to do for many, many years. One, the seismometer, and the other one, this probe that's going to bang itself 15 or 16 feet to the ground. The other main experiment is they want to find out the wobble of Mars, and the way they're going to do that is they're going to transmit an X-band signal from Earth to the orbit, to the lander itself, and over time they're going to figure out the difference in frequency, you know, the time that the signals come back to our Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and actually our Applied Physics Lab, I think, is really going to be going back to, and they'll look at it and they'll be able to tell information about the wobble of Mars, and that will give them information about the interior of Mars by using the transmission of a X-band signal. So that's the story on that. There's plenty of other things to cover here, but since this is the main topic, if anybody have any questions or comments, again, this will be on NASA TV starting tomorrow at 2 o'clock. You'll get information at probably 3:08 or something like that on whether or not it was successful in landing. And then as the hours tick by all the way to around 8 o'clock at night, you'll probably, by that time, you'll definitely have your first picture coming back. You'll have a camera on board. And unfortunately, no microphone. We always talked about having a microphone on one of these missions. Probably have that on the 2020 mission a couple of years from now. Any comments or questions? This is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet.
WS2N, Katie, keep me up with a question.
Okay, I heard my call and I heard something about a question. I missed your call altogether. Try again.
Hey, it's Kilo Delta 2 Papa Foxtrot. I was just wondering, the drilling, is going to be shored? Or, I mean, is it going, it doesn't have to be, shored down. It's just going to drill from its own weight? Is that correct?
Yeah, it's a pretty cool gadget. More of a bolt point type of thing. You know, if you were to take a bolt point chisel type of thing and hold it in your hand and hit it with a hammer over and over again, eventually that thing will keep on going into the ground. But the way they do it, it's inside this canister. Now we'll be sitting on the surface of Mars. So this whole gadget, motorized thing and everything, it will be going down on the ground with this bolt point chisel. so nothing's spinning. It's just a constant hammering. And the way they get the hammering effect is this motor inside, and the motor turns this cam roughly near the bottom of it, you know, inside this cylinder, and it turns this cam. As it pushes on the cam, pushes against the spring, you know, raising this full point chisel, you know, up a few inches.